Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Every Other Week Tuesday Night Open Call, and we're open. Carrie and I are here so far, and we're going to wait and see who else we manage to snag along the way as far as moderators go and other people. I don't know how much of a crowd we'll have tonight because of the debate starting in, what, about a half hour? Could be a pretty light crowd tonight, but we take it as we get it. And if people have got questions, we'll try and help out with what people need. If not, we can wrap things up fairly early, and then maybe we'll be able to go and watch the
comments.
I don't know what kind of words to put on it. So a few of the words that I'd use, that I could use, I would not use on this call. So to describe it, but it should be a pretty interesting evening, and I guess they're expecting a lot of people. Are expecting somewhere around 90 million people to tune in. So it ought to be pretty interesting. So anyway, we are here, and of course it is a Tuesday night, and I'm still looking for John and Larry and Jesse, and I don't know if everybody just got what.
You know what, Dave? Since there's no sports events this year, we got to take the spectacles we can get.
Well, exactly, and this should be an interesting spectacle too. I didn't know they'd replace sports with comedy.
Well, sometimes sports are comedy.
Yeah, but you know, it is what it is. So anyway, we're here, and we'll see if we can round up some of the rest of the crew here. There's John. He just hopped on. Good evening, Sir John. How are you? Sir John. Hello, hello.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hey, how are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. You have any word from Jesse about not being here?
I don't, but let me
go. I don't see him anywhere. So I don't know if we're going to have much of a crowd here tonight. Like Carrie and I were just talking with the advent of the debate tonight. I think that's going to draw a fair amount of attention from a lot of people this time around, and that's expected. And I mean, you know, if we don't have a big crowd, if we don't have questions, well, you know, we know how to wrap things up and say good night. But I'll go ahead and do a disclaimer with Jesse not being here at the moment, just so that's out of the way and case we get lost in the shuffle here. But if you came here looking for legal advice, you're going to be sorely disappointed, because you're not going to get any tonight. We never give legal advice. That can only be given by bar licensed attorneys, and none of us are bar licensed attorneys. We don't know what legal advice is. I've never been able to figure that. They've got some little magic trick that the moment you get a bar card that you know what it is, and I haven't got a bar card, so no knowledge of legal advice. So, again, if you're looking for legal advice, you're best to go do a little shopping, find yourself a bar-licensed attorney and pay their fee, and hopefully you'll get some decent legal advice. You know, that is questionable at times. We know that, but it is what it is. So, you know, we just do the best that we can, and we answer questions. We talk about our situations if we've got anything going on. And in the meantime, if people have got questions for us, we'll try and answer those. And if we don't have any questions for us, then we have other things to do, actually. I do want to listen to the debate, whether it be live or whether it be delayed, where I have to listen to it later on, you know, we don't schedule this call around presidential debates. This is a regular every other week, and this is our week. So, again, if you want legal advice, go find yourself a bar licensed attorney. I'm sure they'll be happy to help you, and they'll, of course, without a doubt, want a nice, healthy retainer to do so, but that's the way that business works, so you're not going to find it here. So, anyway, with that said, still waiting to see if Jesse joins us here pretty quick, and if we've got any questions from our callers. What's that?
He hasn't responded to the text message.
Yeah. Well, he may be tied up doing something. I don't know.
Yep, we'll get this to you.
But, you know, we'll just see what we got. And here again, I'm going to tell everybody tonight the same thing that I tell everybody every week that we're on here, is the way you get yourself on your hand up in the air to be able to ask a question is hit the one key on the keypad on your phone. And that puts a signal up on the board here that I can see, and we try and take people in the order that they raise their hands and request to, you know, ask a question. But the bottom line is, if we don't have any other people with questions, we're going to say goodnight, sayonara. Toodaloo and all that good stuff, and we're going to be off to do other things because all of us moderators have other things we can and need to do, and we will do that. So I don't have any good news. Do any of our other moderators have any good news at this point that they want to share with us? We'll start out with that.
No, it's raining, and that keeps me out of the hot tub, so that's not good news.
Well, actually, the only good news I've got is we've got some temperate weather with lower humidity, which is very nice after 3 months of rotten humidity and much higher temperatures. So it was down in the 50s this morning. It was a beautiful day here, and with the low humidity, it's finally very comfortable to go out and do things like walking and stuff again. So, you know, we try and get out and do that as much as we can. I haven't been able to do a lot of that this summer because of the extremely high humidity here. And humidity and I don't get along very well. I can handle the heat. I handled 130-some degrees over in Vietnam and, you know, where
that's
I used to work. In the,
yeah.
Yeah. Work in a second shift at the International Harvester Plant up in Illinois 40 years ago. The ambient temperature where I worked around the furnaces was between 135 and 140. So, you know, I know what heat is, but humidity
I grew up in Death Valley. So. Trust me, I know what the heat is.
Yep.
But, you know, the weather, I can't ride a bike either, so I'm stuck in the house. It's been about 3 days. It's been raining, so, you know, maybe it'll clear up tomorrow.
Well, if it doesn't, I guess you probably won't be out again. It's not like we control it, so.
Nothing lasts forever.
Well, anyway, yep. All right. Well, if none of the other moderators have anything they want to jump in with, let's just go ahead and see what kind of questions we've got here. And we'll take those, and when we run out of people with questions, then we will close up shop for tonight, and we'll do it again in 2 weeks, because that's the way we operate here. So we're going to go to our caller that's got all ones. And I know who that is. You're
right.
Unmuted. Go ahead.
All right, how's everybody doing on that end?
Pretty good.
Okay. All right, okay. All right, okay. Now, this is all about this Midland case. Okay. Now, on Friday, I hand-delivered the motion for the court to grant a filing for unilateral protective order. The clerk file the motion on Monday at 11 a.m.
Okay.
At 1:35 p.m., Midland Council filed their motion for joinder and consolidation. All right.
Okay.
All right. So now, I think we have a stupid lawyer moment because the lawyer filed an Exhibit A of my complaint and an Exhibit B of Kim's complaint.
Right.
What was stupid is filed the wrong complaint for Kim.
The what?
They filed the wrong complaint for Kim.
Oh, my God. What complaint did they file?
Okay, in their argument. Oh.
The complaint they filed, what happened was when I filed my original complaint, I also filed an amended complaint. And what happened was...
Well, now, wait a minute. You filed your original complaint, but then you followed it up with an amended complaint afterwards, right?
Correct. Because they have not been served yet. Either.
Okay. All right. Well, I just want to get it clear for everybody that listens. You didn't file them both at the same time or anything, obviously. I just want to make that clear to everybody. So you filed your original complaint. They hadn't been served, so you filed your first amended complaint.
That's correct. So, like, for example, I filed my first complaint in December, and then I filed my second complaint all the way in June. Because I filed also like a form of papyrus, and the judge did not grant it, so it took me that long to get funds together to go back and okay. So
okay.
With the stupid
so you
is,
you got the funds you got the funds together, but then you went ahead and paid the filing fee and filed your second amended complaint, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you. You make it so clear. I need to speak slower and more precise. So what Brian is saying is they filed. Oh, by the way, so they answered the second amended complaint. They answered it.
The first amended complaint.
I'm sorry. The first amended complaint, they answered it.
Okay. So they're up to date. They're up to date on... answering the newest
complaint, but they attached
right. The
moot non-existent complaint to their motion.
They attached the original complaint as an exhibit.
Yeah,
correct.
Which is moot at this point.
Yeah, that was a stupid lawyer moment.
It was major.
Oh, that's just a clerical error.
And I think it's funny.
Well, yeah. It's the wrong complaint. That's not what is the operative complaint.
Word, operative. Okay, so see, Dave, here's our question now. Because they are using a lot of arguments actually addressing Exhibit B, which is the wrong complaint.
Well, that's what you have to argue.
Okay, perfect. And that is what we're doing. We're arguing that, saying an error and things like that. But see, this is Brian's confusion. This is Brian's complaint.
Yeah.
So how do we separate?
That's nothing to do with you.
Well.
Why?
There really is no, you don't need to separate. They're two separate issues, two separate people, two different cases, and one has nothing to do with the other.
Yeah.
So
and they're trying to tie them together, but they got stupid And in their argument to join the cases, their arguments are made and their exhibits are based on your original complaint rather than the first amended complaint, which is the operative complaint.
And everything is, catch this phrase, it's all irrelevant because between the two cases, there is no issue, no nucleus of operative fact. There is no relation, no nucleus of operative fact between the two, no association between the two cases.
Right, and the biggest thing is you need to point out to the court that they are arguing to combine the cases based on a document that is moot, i.e., the original complaint, which is no longer the operative complaint.
I'd also file a motion to strike.
Yeah.
I'd strike the document. Then the court can't consider it. And if the court says it can consider it, then you're going to have an appealable issue.
Right. Always remember to set yourself up properly for appeal if you have to go there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay, so my question is now, thank you for that, Frank. I didn't even thought of that. So because they addressed Bride, this went to him with both our names on it now. They have Plaintiff Brian and Plaintiff Kim. Is Brian the only one filing, or am I filing something different too?
No, you don't file in his case.
Right.
See, they haven't been joined yet, so it's only Brian's case.
Right.
They're trying to trap you into agreeing to that. And if you start filing something in his case, well, then you agree.
Yeah. Yeah, they're trying to create a big cloud of smoke and you know, blur the issues. Well, no. See, if the cases had been joined, then you're both plaintiffs. That'd be a different story. But, you know, like we said, it's still just Brian's case. This is just something that they're trying to move the court to do. It hasn't been done yet. So he is the one that's been filed in his case. And you're not going to be one that responds. You have to argue. Brian has to argue his.
That issue, trying to drag you into it at this point, is nothing more than a lawyer-constructed smoke and mirrors. It means nothing to you. That's not your case. You don't have anything to do with it, and you don't want anything to do with it. They're just trying to drag you into it.
Instead,
yeah, and
instead,
Brian's arguments to this have to be strictly from his viewpoint. Just, I want to remind you, keep in mind that you don't make any arguments related to you. Do you see what I mean? You don't put anything in there it's like it's coming from you to the court in argument. Be careful with any wording you use. It all has to be his argument.
His issue, his case, his argument, his bus, and he's driving it.
Right.
All right, John, you were trying to say something?
Yeah, I don't know if you've done it already, but you probably do know that Midland violated their consent order. The whole group of companies violated their consent order, and the Justice Department was after him for that, and I forget if they've entered into a new one, but there was an order about that. So I'd file probably 3 requests for judicial notice and put the consent agreement in there and then the notice of them violating the consent agreement. And if there's a new consent agreement already, filing that in too, because it's just to malign the other party, but it also paints the picture, you know, as they're going to try to tie you guys up or whatever, it's just going to make them look bad in front of the judge. It's going to draw the judge's attention to that, and it's going to get it on the record that you've made notice about that. It's the way
right.
they operate. And I'm sure you've probably already mailed their attorneys debt validation letters. Have you done that?
Yes.
And did they validate?
No.
It's not your debt.
Well,
no.
It's not,
no.
I don't have... Well,
no,
in my
right.
case, in
right.
my
I don't
case,
have
I don't even have a debt with them. I'm just
no.
I'm,
you
just,
still send them a debt validation letter.
Yeah, right.
Really?
It's
even,
because
even
they need to
oh,
validate
yeah.
that you have one,
right?
And they can't. That's the
they
whole point.
And you send that to the lawyers, and if they can't validate, and they're still continue to argue for their client, and you can very craftily. You know, throw something in there that they have to address, and then you get them like, aha, on the federal docket. That's what you need to do to sue them.
Huh? Wait.
Okay. Yeah, and by, you know, what John said about doing a motion for judicial notice and attaching those consent decrees and stipulated agreements in those cases, you are showing the court that they have a track record of misbehavior that they are not willing to address or change.
And what I was trying to say is that for each one of the documents you're going to file in, file a separate motion for judicial notice. Now, the difference
yeah.
between just judicial notice and the motion for judicial notices, if you just merely stick it in, the court may pay attention to it. If you request judicial notice, the court must look at it. They must look at it. By making each one set out in a separate motion, if the other side wants to, you know, move against it, strike it, or do anything like that, it multiplies the proceedings. So it could be 2 or 3 more things that they have to address in addition to, you know, the motion just. If they filed more than one documents that need to be struck, do a separate motion for each one of them. And it
right.
multiplies the proceedings. You know, you can cut and paste everything and just put the little pertinent bit in there, but they still have to, each thing you throw out on the docket, they have to address it, or if they don't, that's an acceptance of that fact. So you can make it really nasty, and then they got to suddenly think, how much time do we want to waste with these people?
Mm-hmm.
Because time is money, and their clients have to pay their billable hours to deal with each one of those separate nuisance motions you're going to make and requests you're going to make. And like John said, they either have to answer it, agree to it, or argue it. And if they argue it, that's money out of their clients' pockets, more and more for everything you file.
Right, and I can tell you from personal experience, even in recent days, that when you file a lawsuit against a company like that, and the lawyer that's representing them balks on anything, if you get a few digs in there they have to address that you can put your teeth in, you just file another lawsuit against the attorney that you're fighting. It'll draw things to a conclusion really, really quick.
Hey, okay, so now with this debt validation letter, do I send it to the lawyer or do I send it to Midland?
No, you send it
to the lawyer.
Whatever lawyer has signed a document, if 3 separate lawyers are working on the case and they've all individually signed different things, even like sometimes you get one from the head of the firm that says, you know, we're doing such as, send each one of them a debt validation letter and send one addressed just to the firm.
And you
because
know what?
You can
it took a while for
the lawyer.
It took a while for John to make me understand why I needed to do that because I just didn't get it. And so finally I just said, okay, I don't really get it, but I'm going to do it. So I did, and I got to tell you, that sent those lawyers into the most hysterical tailspin. They didn't know what to make of it. They didn't know how to deal with it. They all sent me emails. I didn't try to collect anything from you. What is this about? And I didn't answer them. I just ignored them. And they just chased their tails round and round and round and went nuts.
Wow. Yeah, I sued a company in state court, and then the lawyer dicked around on that, and I turned around and filed against him and his firm in federal court, and it took me about a month and a half to get the whole thing settled. And
so you do that. You do that for every lawyer that touched it.
I have a private investigator that I use for certain cases, you know, with people that I want to harass, let's say. So I had the lawyer served at home.
So now this debt validation letter, this is just a regular one that you send out to a bank. It's the same type of validation.
Same validation letter.
We use the same letter for everything.
No special language, no nothing.
Yeah, they're not special.
And it's not too late to do that right now?
Nope.
No.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay.
You can send them anytime you want to. That's the fun.
You got to understand one thing about debt validation letters. Please, everybody that listens to this, pay attention to this particular point. There is absolutely no down at any point in time to sending a debt validation letter to somebody like a debt collector, a lawyer, anybody. There is no downside to it. You've got everything to gain and nothing to lose by doing so.
That's right.
If in doubt,
and
send
you know,
it.
You can send them more than once, too. I mean, they could do something in the beginning, and you find the problem with that, and you can turn around and then sue them in federal court, and then a couple months later, they sue them, and all because the game was slow, or do something else.
Is everybody else hearing that electronic noise?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. I don't know if that's coming from John's or what, but...
That was me. That was me.
Okay. We didn't hear you, John. Whatever you just said.
Yeah, you need to say that again, please.
What I was saying is that you could have, in a case like yours, a situation where, you know, they do something and you find a violation and you send them a debt validation letter and they come back, they don't validate, and then you go ahead and sue them. And then, so that's an ongoing case in federal court, and then a month, 2 months go by and they do some other stupid filing in the first case, you know, your middling case, and you find a problem with that and you mail them another debt validation letter. And they don't answer right, and you sue them again, but that time you do it in state court. You could have two ongoing cases with separate nucleuses of operative fact in different venues, which means they have to hire different attorneys.
Wow.
And it's, you know, it's just what you do, you know? It's just what you do. It's what anyone could do if they had a lot of money and could hire a bunch of law firms.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. All right. I want to make sure one thing. I know we had the debt validation letter on the website, right? And it's just a request to validate a debt. But how are you going to validate something that you can't put down? That's why I'm lost.
You're falling into the trap that Terry did. You need to understand what Terry was telling you about what she did. There wasn't anything really that they were trying to collect from Terry. It's just that when they got that, it freaked them out. And then they started chasing their tails because they wondered what she was up to.
Right. And I can tell you
there
something.
There doesn't need to be a debt to demand validation. You know, you're saying validate it. They're saying validate what? And you're like, exactly.
But what I like, you know, it comes down to about, you know, dear so-and-so, I am in receipt of your communication in which you allege a debt, and I deny the same and demand validation sincerely. That is a complete statement, because validation, we know what that is, and alleging a debt is clearly in the FDCPA and most state laws, you know, where they're saying it's either a debt or an alleged debt. FDCPA says it can be an alleged debt. So that's all they have to do is allege debt.
Wow.
Wow, okay, that's...
Yeah, you don't want to make this too difficult.
Right, and what it comes
really
down
don't.
To, alleging a debt and what that actually is, that is a question of fact for the fact finder when you go to a jury trial, because the court can't really say what it is, because those type of things are subject to interpretation, and depending which circuit you're in, it could be the least sophisticated consumer standard or, you know, something similar to that could be a little higher, a little lower. And so that's what has to, you know, the question of fact over the document and how it could be interpreted. The judge can't do that, because he can't just do that himself, because that's a question for the fact finder, which is a jury. And creating an issue like that is something that means you can survive into a appeal, and it's an appealable case that you will win. It will come back in your favor, and then it's going to be back in court, and it's going to cost them a lot of money. And they know that. They can analyze these things, but it's really that simple. There is no debt, but they alleged one. They alleged one, and because they filed it in court and they've signed the filing, that means they, under their code of professional conduct, they have to have made an investigation to determine whether what they were saying was correct or not. They're not just supposed to be paid liars for their client.
They're supposed to have
a higher ethical level. Yeah, even though they are, but they're supposed to have a higher ethical level. So they're going to go ahead and do what they're going to do, and that's why you're going to sue them, and that's how you're going to win.
Wow.
And it's
it works. I'm telling you, just for the nuisance factor, it is hilarious. Those guys about lost their minds.
Because
and they
the
just kept sending me emails, and I kept ignoring them.
They're employing the court in the perpetration of a fraud. They're violating their professional code of conduct and ethics. And they're really doing, you know, criminal work on behalf of a criminal organization that had to enter in an agreement with the federal government so that their owners didn't have to go to jail and the company was taken away. So, you know, these people, you know, are borderline.
And then they violated that.
Part of a criminal enterprise, which is a RICO violation.
Exactly.
Now, you don't want to file RICO, but you can always tell the other side when you get down the road that, you know, you're in discussions from some attorneys that would like to make this into a RICO case.
Oh, that'll really make them crazy.
Yeah, because that sends them to jail. But you probably shouldn't have to go that far. You just have to be willing to do what you got to be willing to do. Yes, it costs money to file cases, but, you know, if you look at the time value of money and how long it takes to take a case through that takes 2.5 years compared to punching them and then punching the two lawyers too, it's going to bring them down a lot quicker. They aren't going to want to deal with it for their client. You know, they can always afford, you know, on the averages to lose one here and there.
The client's not going to want to pay the monumental amount of money to push it that far on something this silly and this low of an amount.
They can lose a client that costs them too much money. It depends.
Yep.
If they're on a flat fee retainer where, you know, you've got a bunch of attorneys that just only do your stuff and, you know, like a Frank Springfield type guy, then They aren't going to put too much in there before they move to get it settled, because they don't have an unlimited bucket coming from their client. They've got a predetermined thing. The ones that have an unlimited bucket that can just bill, like that one in Tampa that we've all dealt with in Florida. It's a small firm, but eventually...
No, I mean that King and Spalding is the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
They're on a flat contract.
Because the client... Oh, no, I meant the ones that just bill. They, you know, they lose their client because it cost them too much and they didn't work in the client's behalf. They work on their own behalf. So it depends, you know, what type of law firm you're fighting. But generally, when you start gouging into the lawyers themselves, you know, that's a waste of their time, or they have to hire someone else to defend them, and they shouldn't represent themselves because they're pretty stupid if they do. And, you know, because think about it. If you sued an attorney, if an attorney was representing Midland, and then you sued that attorney for what they were saying, and then they tried to represent themselves when they were being sued, anything they put into the case, you probably could turn around and sue them again in separate lawsuits, because it would be a separate nucleus of operative facts.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Like, you know, you get out of the car at the store and you step in the bubble gum. And then you come back out and you forget about it and you step in it with your other foot. It's the same piece of bubble gum in the same parking lot outside your car, but different feet, different time.
Wow. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Now, I know that the next move is to oppose their motion. Does Kim have to file an opposition too?
No, he just said no.
Oh, okay.
No. That's what we've been talking about.
Right.
It's only your case.
Right.
It's only your case.
She wouldn't know.
You don't
we're trying
want
to bring her into
her.
It.
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
that's
you
what
don't
I was saying.
You don't need to even talk about her. You just need to talk. The only reference you make to her is another case that does not involve you with another plaintiff other than you. Your case has nothing to do with that other case. You don't go on about, well, she may be my wife, but I don't have anything to do with that. No, that's irrelevant. She's just another case that they're trying to drag in.
Right, but you need to point out, and on top of that, Your Honor, the defendants have argued based on a non-existent or moot first or original complaint when the operative complaint is a first amended complaint and the exhibits attached to their motion, the exhibits attached to their motion to join are based on the original complaint, which is moot.
Right.
A glaring error on the part of the defendants.
And if you move to strike the document, then they have
right.
no foundation to rest their arguments upon. And so you can dispose a lot of, you know, dealing with the small stuff by saying they're making arguments on a document that has nothing to do with this case. And we've moved to strike it. So they'd have to refile with some other thing to correct it, and then you can come back and make the arguments about, well, she's not a party in this case, and they can't show how it would be related. Because and it depends on what state you're in, you know, what is a marriage looked at as being like a corporation with two people, or are they independent people that happen to be joined together?
Now, it's North Carolina, we're a common law state, so what's his is his, hers is hers. The only time that they're joined is if they enter into something together.
Yeah, exactly. So you can argue it very simply that it's an unrelated party.
Exactly.
And for them to say you're related, well, show us how does that affect in the FDCPA or in the type of consumer law we're dealing with.
Nothing is said about that kind of relationship in any of the consumer laws we deal with.
Well, there's plenty of cases where people have been sued and they try to bring the partner or spouse in on it and then they can't, and that's considered a violation. So really, you know, Kim, because they filed your case in on someone else's case, that's a violation. They've told a third party about an alleged debt.
Yes, beyond just doing it over the phone. Now they've done it in public because that case is public
on the record.
On
the record, so you can sue them, right? You can sue the lawyers right off the bat with that.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you can do that, I wouldn't hesitate to do it right away. You put a complaint together, this is what they did, and have them served right away.
Oh, I would in a hot second.
Oh, okay, hold on. Time out. Yo. Okay. Wait. Okay, now you're talking about me now. You're saying for me to sue the lawyers now. Is that correct?
They drag your personal business into the public square.
Right, and they put it in front of him. And, you know, they're not allowed to tell third parties.
So that's another FDCPA violation again.
Correct. And I just thought of something else. Because they're filing it in on his case, they're attempting to get him to pay your debt.
Yeah.
So he can sue him for that. How is that? All he has to say, how is that my debt? Why did you bring it in this case? And you know, that right there is going to make them pause and think, what the hell are we going down this road for?
And who are we dealing with?
Yeah. And they don't have to be very complicated complaints. You know, it's pretty simple what, you know, they violated this and they violated that and, you know, they told a third party about my alleged debt, and then, you know, he can say, well, they were attempting to collect a debt that I'm not legally obligated to pay and know nothing about.
First they blab about somebody else's debt to me over the phone, and now they try to drag it into my lawsuit.
Well,
what is wrong with these people?
Discussing it over the phone is a violation. Discussing it with a third party over the phone is a violation. They don't know, you know, you guys could be like, you know, cats and dogs going at it, you know, every bit of the day. And the only reason you're not divorced is because you don't have the filing fee at the moment because you're dealing with the crummy debt collectors. And
because,
you know,
of COVID, that didn't matter.
You know, yeah, whatever it is, you know, you're having to cohabitate because of COVID and you're unemployed, you know, whatever it is, they don't know your personal circumstances or your interrelation. Some people just remain married because they can't be bothered to spend the money. You know, what difference is it going to make?
Exactly.
So for them to, if they even bring that argument, you know, you can start, you know, spitting and cussing at that point.
They have really stepped in a really big pile of smelly stuff.
Yeah, if they think you're at home, you know, colluding together on what you're going to do, you know, they can try to bring it together and put it in one lawsuit. Or, like in a lot of times, it's only one of the parties that's fighting, the other one could care less, you know, fighting the lawsuits, you know. And someone's filing cases, you know, for someone else. But you can come right back and not even address the being married issue. If they want to bring all that up, they can really, you know, step in it and you know,
how they already have.
Right.
Okay. So I have a question. That was way over my head. Fighting. Yes.
Glad it's on record.
I'm
being recorded.
All right. Now, you all said something like I had mentioned to Dave and Terry on a previous call, they had wrote down husband and wife. We never told them it was husband and wife, but like Dave said, they probably put two and two together. But I also said, Brian, who said that we are happily husband and wife? We can be in separate whatever to put them together.
But that's not even an issue that you want to bring up.
Right.
Right,
because they don't know if you're estranged under the same roof. A, that's none of their business, and just because you have the same name, they're making a big assumption there. You could easily be brother and sister.
What they're bringing up there is irrelevant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So you got to break it all down. It sounds like there needs to be a motion to strike and a motion in opposition. It doesn't have to go into great depths with the motions to strike and getting some lawsuits going.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I will go look up motion to strike. We never did a motion to strike before, so this is, again, brand new.
It's
so,
very easy.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very
easy. There's not that much to
them.
There's usually like four or five things you have to include in there that, you know, it's irrelevant, it's unrelated to the case, it's to embarrass, it's to do this, it's to do that. So, you know, you just hit the...
There's at least a couple of them in my Midland case at the Southern District of Georgia.
Okay, Brian, you got that? You got to look it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
wow.
I caught two or three of them.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you, Terry.
Wow.
That's helpful. We've been using your work anyway. Everybody, we're looking up John, Dave, Larry. We're looking at everybody's cases. So it's been
Yeah, well, this is the only area in American law where it's not only legal, it is encouraged to plagiarize.
That's right.
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 And so if you do those and then you sue those, if you both sue the lawyers on the separate issues that they can't combine together, oh, man, they're not going to be very happy. I mean, it'll be good.
Yeah.
And make sure you sue the lawyer and the law firm.
If you think you're having fun now, you just wait and see how much fun you have then. Been there, done that. Lots of fun.
Okay. Now, I have another question here. Now, on their certificate of service, they have Tim's phone number as my number, and I asked the council in an email to change the phone number. They still filed the paperwork incorrectly. Can I use the email as evidence as they are being deceptive? Because if we have
That's not relevant
that's
to the case. Yeah, that's not relevant to the facts of the case.
Okay. All right.
It won't make a difference on anything one way or the other. So the court would see that as splitting hairs, digging into the minutia.
Okay. Now, another question. Now that we have started the discovery process and did initial disclosure, do I need to wait for a decision from this joinder thing to before I can serve them with my first set of interrogatory admissions and production?
Yeah, as soon as you're done with your 26F conference and the judge puts out a scheduling order, you can commence discovery. And based on what you had in your scheduling conference, the federal rules say you have to deliver the initial disclosures within 14 days, but it can be altered in the scheduling order with a different date. They usually try to push it out further because you really should lean on them to see what kind of evidence you can get right up front easy. But we've discussed with you previously how to get what to do with the other side. If they don't send their initial disclosures, you can send them an email and then maybe print out a copy and send it with a letter and mail it where they've got proof that it's delivered at the other end. And then that ties them down because anything that they fail to disclose, you can do a motion in limine. It's not admissible as evidence for trial.
Okay. So we
that was
we
a
did.
Lot, but, you know, you had your scheduling order already, correct?
Right. And the judge.
Yeah, you can start discovery.
Right. Okay.
They do a crapshoot whether or not they think you're going to send discovery or not to send discovery, because a lot of people don't even know what to do when they get to that point in a case, and you need to have at least, it takes 30, once they get it, they got 30 days or so to respond to it, and then they usually give you a bunch of crap or don't respond. You got to send an email. You have to wait for their response. You have to do like 2 go-rounds before you can even do a motion to compel. So it's really almost 2 months down the road before you can do a motion to compel, and depending on your court, how long it takes to get a hearing to get that stuff out. And if you have a short time frame and you don't motion for an enlargement of time, you can win at a motion to compel hearing, but because the time for discovery is already expired, it's moot, and you're screwed.
Yeah.
So discovery itself is a huge battlescape that's very time critical, and you have to address it. We've covered that completely in a lot of webinars, you know, point by point, exactly what you have to do. But you want to get going on that as soon as possible.
Okay. He had to step away. So he's doing his discovery. He's doing a motion to strike. He's doing an opposition letter.
You're doing an opposition to their motion to join?
Opposition, yes. Wow. Okay. Okay, he's busy.
Yep.
Okay.
But you gotta do it. You gotta get it done. The quicker you can get it done, the better you are. If everything's running on the deadline, you don't want the judge to finally find something, oh, I can rule on this quick and make it all go away, and then you gotta go the appeal route. So, you know, the quicker he can get stuff in there, the better. If you get one document done, you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait to have them all done to go to the courthouse. You can get that one filed and then start working on the next one. But get them done as quickly as you can. Or you can go to the courthouse. He's writing.
Okay. All right. Oh, and his last stupid lawyer moment is that, you want to tell him about the case laws?
Yeah. Well,
that they had filed all these case laws, three different case law, and they all were in his favor.
Well, you need to point that out to the court.
That's why you got to always look them up and read them, because they are that
right.
dumb.
And where did he file the case? Where did they file the case law in?
This is in North Carolina.
No. I mean, what was it? In one of the motions or what?
What argument?
Do?
The argument was, it says here, Federal Rule Civil Procedure 19 requires joiner of Kim Green as a necessary party. And so they cite case law, Bodner versus Jackson.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So it was in that current motion. Then all he's got to do is argue against it. Many times they use case law that reads right to them when they cut and paste, but when you look at the entire case, that wasn't the conclusion. So it was, what was it, Dave? What did you call it? Inopposite?
Well,
inopposite.
It is not analogous to
right.
the facts at hand. And that's spelled A-N-A-L-O-G-O-U-S, analogous. But the main thing is you have to point out to the court where the case law that they cited actually supports your argument that there should be no joinder. And you have
right.
to quote whatever it is out of there that states that.
Yeah.
They do that stupid stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah. All the time. That's why it's so important.
I'd say better than 50% of the time.
Ditto.
Right. So is it relevant to the case, basically, when they keep doing that.
Well, no, you don't say it's irrelevant. You have to they misstate the conclusions in case Smith versus Jones, where they state such and such, where the actual decision stated such and such and so and so, which is exactly opposite of and does not support the defendant's argument for joinder, and but rather instead supports plaintiff's argument to deny the motion for joinder.
So is therefore not analogous to their argument.
Correct. And the reason,
yep.
And just illustrate it, the reason why. And you have to do that because of the famous case where the judge said that judges were not like pigs looking for truffles hidden in briefs.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You have to put it right out there where they can find it.
Right, right. Terry advances the proposition that the sky is green and relies on her argument within the case of such and such, but a clear reading of the case indicates the opposite in it, wherein it states that the sky is blue. Therefore, her argument fails.
Okay.
Wow, thank you. My last question is, after reading the book Making Your Case by Scalia and Garner,
Scalia and Garner.
Yes. When you do a conclusion and then you do a wherefore statement, I'm seeing, like, this lawyer, he does work, and he never does a wherefore statement. And I'm like, why? My thought was that you should always have a wherefore statement.
I would recommend that. We all
look
do.
Look at it this way.
And
lawyers are lazy, and they get away with it. We are never lazy, and we set examples for other people like us not to be lazy. It's that simple.
And a wherefore statement is generally only about 3, 4, maybe 5 lines at the very, very, very most.
To make
it's
it clear
just
to the
you're
court
saying, wherefore,
what you're asking
this is
for.
What I'm asking the court to do, period.
Yeah.
Okay. It was very clear in this book. I'm like, okay, I like that. And I know we've been doing it because this is how you had taught us to do it since we started. We always put a wherefore statement at the end.
Well, that's where you ask for the order. You got to ask for the order if you want to get results, and you have to be specific. The reason you, wherefore, for the above stated reasons, plaintiff requests that this honorable court issue an order that blank 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 blank.
Yeah, denies defendant's motion for joinder and any such just and equitable additional remedies the court sees appropriate.
Yep.
Yeah. See, the whole thing is, you just remember the difference between the two. A conclusion is a summary of things. That's where they conclude, well, you know, this and this and this and this, and that's going to be a whole paragraph. Your wherefore statement is your last, this is what I want the court to do. It's a very concise, short statement. This is the conclusion isn't requesting the court. They're saying, well, this is what the court should do, you know, in general terms. But the wherefore statement is very specific. You're asking the court to deny their motion, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Done.
And if they put three arguments in their motion that they're trying to do, you can start off with your first paragraph saying that that the plaintiff is attempting to, you know, do the following, an opposition on this motion for the following reasons, and you state in there the order that you're asking for right in the beginning, and the next paragraph can say that the defendants are arguing the following, for the following three reasons, which the plaintiff will address in turn. And then you go into one, first, second, and third. You address and dispose of each one of those, and then your conclusion brings for and your conclusion brings it back, and you restate the three arguments simply. And that's the reason you're asking for the wherefore statement. And it's sort of, you know, one part goes more in depth and one lays out what you're looking for. And by telling the court exactly what you're looking for relief in the beginning, and then the three arguments the case has made and why they all fail, then going into in depth in each with the case law supporting your side, then drawing it back together in a conclusion in a brief way, and then the wherefore statement asks for the relief based on what you've said in your conclusion. And they can read the beginning, and they know what to look for going through the middle, and then the end says exactly what you want again, and that's the best way to lay it out, it seems.
Okay. Wow. Okay, this is going to be fun. Because my turn be next. Yay. Well, thank you. I'm going to digest some of this, and so is Brian, and I'm going to give someone else a chance to speak.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
You have lots of fun giving them nightmares.
There you go. All right, we're going to go to 209. You're unmuted for your question. Or good news, whichever you got.
No, I have a question. Thank you. Well, that last segment was really good. I don't know what kind of case, if they were suing or being sued, but
they're suing.
Great.
They're the plaintiffs.
Okay. Well, I'm in California. I'm being sued, and I'm trying to get some help on discovery. Dwayne in Chicago told me that one of you guys, probably Dave, I think, but I'm not sure, has a really good document in there, a sample of discovery. I'm just having trouble, man.
That's John. John has that.
I'm having a lot of trouble wrapping my brain around it. I have that Craig, somebody's, document on how to fight, debt collector cases, and he has some pretty good points in there, but I'm just having a really hard time to try to, set it down in writing, and I'm wondering.
Are you a member of the website?
Yeah.
Well, if you go into the webinar archive and then look for the beating credit card section, I think I have four or five whole webinars on discovery, and it gives you samples of the discovery, and it explains the reason why some of the questions that may not make sense, why they're in there, because primarily it's to set them up so you can sue them in federal court. You sue them in federal court while you're still in state court, and it usually gets things settled right away. But some of the answers that, for example, if you were being sued by Midland, then when Midland answers the discovery, it makes the lawyers be in violation of federal law, so you turn around and sue the lawyers right away, because the admissions from Midland are the evidence for the violations, basically that they're a real party in interest in the collection, because they're making a percentage on a retainer fee, on a conditional fee. So, but there's interrogatories, requests for production, and admissions all in there, and it shows you how to do two rounds of discovery, how to try to get them to answer them when they don't do it correctly, how to go for a motion to compel, and the reason behind all of it. And then it also has on how to do deposition, video deposition, deuces tecum. So you need to go into the webinar archive and look for the beating credit card section and listen to the discovery webinars.
I'm looking in there right now. I've been looking at them since you opened, because I opened it right away, and I don't see anything that actually says discovery. Nature of the predator dealing with collection, validation, who says to prove it, junk debt buyers, deception, motion to dismiss, affirmative defenses. I don't see anything that says discovery. Complete strategy overview, beating credit card fundamentals,
Well, the complete strategy overview would give you of the names of the webinars you're looking for. That shows you from soup to nuts how to go through the case when you're being sued.
Okay, let me just write that. Okay.
So you really want to look at that because I'd laid stuff out from beginning to end, all the motions and everything you had to do through the whole process.
Okay, guys, you got any tips for, I'm dealing with LVNV Funding. You ever heard of them?
LVNV, yeah.
They're scumbags.
They're a red-headed stepchild of Sherman Industries. They're buyers, too.
Yeah, they're suing in their name. They're saying they bought it, and they're suing me because they own the debt.
No, they don't own the debt.
They own
fragmented data. They are a buyer. They are not a creditor, and they are just posing as one.
Oh, okay. Hey, listen, I was wrong because Gary relayed out all the webinar archives. So if you look under the section that's called Litigation Tools and Resources Webinars, that's where the discovery is. It's like almost at the end. There's discovery and then motions in limine.
I'm making case dealing with when.
Okay, Gary was cleaning really house.
There it is. I got it. Okay.
All right.
Okay,
you see, there's a ton of stuff, right?
Huh?
There's a
Sorry?
Ton of stuff there. There's a lot
Absolutely.
Of stuff.
That's really
so.
Great. But hey, so sorry, I forget. I forget your name. The lady that was just talking about LVNV funding.
Yeah, Terry.
Terry, that's right. Sorry, I know who you are, but kind of brain dead. Okay, so you were saying about LVNV funding that there are buyers, they're posing, they just pose as a owner.
All buyers try to pose as creditors. They try to convince you that what they bought was a debt. No, they did not. They can't buy debts because creditors can't sell them. All they can buy is a spreadsheet full of fragmented data, your name, your address, your social security number, a balance due on something, and maybe an original account number, not always. But that's all they get, okay? They only purchase the right to try to collect something. But you do not have a relationship with them. You never were a party to that transaction. They didn't ask you to agree to a transfer of your debt. That's not a transfer of debt. There is no debt. They create it, and they put their own account number on it.
Okay, so... Where do I start? I've heard a lot of this. Like, I knew, like, they can't sell the debt. The reason they can't sell it is they already wrote it off, and they took a benefit from the IRS. They got a decrease in their, right? They write it off, and they get a deduction for it.
Take a tax deduction.
Yeah.
Right. Once they sell the right, all they sell is the right to collect. Okay, so once they do that, now the original creditor, they can't come and try to collect it because they sold the right to try to collect it. But they can't sue an obligation. You had an obligation, if the account was yours, okay, you had an
Right.
obligation with some company, whatever company that was, or some bank or Sears or whatever. You entered into a contractual obligation to pay something to them, okay? They're not them. You don't have any obligation to them. They made a bad decision to buy a bunch of fragmented data and hope you're dumb enough to pay them. That's all it is.
Okay, so Ben... If that's the case, can I request in discovery a copy of that you know, the agreement.
Sales agreement.
The sales
agreement.
Yes, you can.
When you get to that point, that is something you want to demand, okay? Now, you're going to find a lot of good stuff. In my case, in the Southern District of Georgia, Hinkle versus Midland, before I took it to the 11th Circuit, when it was at the federal court, okay? When you go in mm-hmm. there, you're going to see a lot of stuff on where I had to file motions to compel to make them fork over the purchase agreements. That's what those are called, okay? And there's mm-hmm. back and forth argument. It ended up with the judge ordering them to get them into my hands by 5 o'clock on Friday, okay? But the case law and the arguments you're going to need to force them to hand that over, you're going to find in those motions to compel in my case.
Okay. Awesome. Can't think of any questions, so let me get on this, and I'll see you guys in what, 2 weeks or 1 week?
2 weeks.
Or you can, and then if you're on my email list, and you need to be on my call Thursday night. If you're not on my email list, send me an email at Queen Songbird, that's all one word, queensongbird@gmail.com, and just say, put me on the list, please. I will send you the call information for Thursday night, and you need to write that down because I don't send it out every week. Once you're on my list, then you will get an email after every call on Thursday night with the replay link and the replay phone number. So if you want to listen to it again online, you can do that. Or there's a dial-in number you can listen to the call on for at least a couple of weeks. I can only keep three of them in there at a time. But, excuse me, you will get the link, the replay link, after every Thursday night call. But you will not get the call information sent to you every week. You need to write that down. So just get on, send me an email, and I'll put you on my list. And then you don't have to wait 2 weeks for there to be another Jesse call, because mine is every Thursday night.
Okay. Great. I'm on your list, but I'm going to send you an email anyway. Is that okay? Because I don't see them.
Just to make sure, okay? Send that to me anyway. I'll make sure you're in my list, and I'll resend you the call info this time because apparently you don't have it. But write it down, hold on to it, save it in your email, whatever you're going to do, okay?
Okay, Terry, thank you so much. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, I tell you what, folks, it looks like that's the end of it for tonight because, as I said earlier, if you haven't got your hand up, then we're not going to be taking any more calls, and we don't have any other hands up. You know, the debate started just a little bit ago, so I think there's a lot of people paying attention to that. Yeah. So, anyway, I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Excuse me. Hope everybody has a great week. We'll be back here in 2 weeks. And tomorrow on the webinar at 2 o'clock Eastern, I'm going to be doing just a very short update on TCPA, where we stand with the legislation. I'll have a little bit of information on that. There is stuff going on. And we'll do that again at 2 o'clock Central, 3 o'clock Eastern. And then, of course, on Thursday night, Terry has her call, and as she just mentioned a moment ago, if you don't have her call-in information, send an email to queensongbird@gmail.com. That's just one word, queensongbird@gmail.com. Just say, please put me on the list, and she'll get you on there and send you the call information. So Anyway, thanks for joining us tonight. We'll talk to you on Tuesday night, 2 weeks from tonight. Have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 3 Eastern. Good night.
Good night, all.